Session number 895.
General Huttonreal 1, I'm particularly interested in how you first came to be associated with General Milne, because you worked with him for a good many years during the interwar period, beginning in 1920 when you were working with him in Constantinople. When did you first meet him?
Prior to 1914, I was a subaltern in a battery in the 4th Division, and he was CRA. And I knew him quite well then, went to his house and so on. Of course, I was very junior, and he was getting pretty senior. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I went out to France with the battery, and he was CRA of the division. Then he went to Macedonia, and he thought of getting me out there to fill some sort of staff appointment, but he wrote and told me he didn't think it was likely to be anything much happening in that theatre of war. I should undoubtedly get malaria if I went there, and he advised me to stay in France. And I did stay in France till the end of the war, when he asked me to go out there to replace his military secretary. Mm-hmm. And I remained there about 2 years and came home actually with him when he was relieved by General Harrington. I then went to the staff college for I think 2 years, and after staff college I had a, which you mentioned before, an appointment at the War Office as DAAG, and I wasn't there long, I think about a year or 18 months, when I went to a second grade appointment on the General Staff at Eastern Command, where he was commanding, GOC&C Eastern Command, at the Horse Guards.
So you'd obviously got to know him pretty well.
Oh, yes, very well.
What kind of man was he? How would you describe his main characteristics?
Well, he's extremely intelligent. Of course, he'd been through what we call the shop, the Royal Military Academy. He was thoroughly well educated in science and so on. He was a little bit intimidating.
In what sort of way?
Well, people were afraid of him who didn't know him. And he could be a little bit harsh. He would always change if he, if anybody got the courage to go and tell him that he'd been unfair. He would always put things right. But he could be rather severe on people. And, of course, the result was that when he came to command an army, it was extremely well disciplined, and in spite of years of war without any leave and a generally frustrating situation, he never had the slightest trouble with any form of indiscipline whatever. And the army adored him, and they kept up till well after the First World War. In fact, up to the other day, their annual meeting on the Horse Guards and March the Cenotaph and so on. Mm. And for a great many years, they kept up an officer's dinner every year. Mm.
I think that most senior officers have their own particular working style, the way they like to have things done. Did Milne have a particular style of the way he expected his staff and supporting officers to work in association with him?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer that. He expected people to obey the rules. And he took a very dim view of anybody who went outside the approved policy. On the other hand, he was always willing to discuss things personally with individuals who had ideas to offer and to give them full consideration.
When you joined him as GSO 2 in 1924, when he was commanding Eastern Command. Was there during this period any tank units attached to Eastern Command?
No.
So during this period, there were no combined exercises with tank forces?
Well, I'm not, not as far as he was concerned, but you know, they had a big manoeuvres in the eastern counties.
Did you become involved in that?
In a small way. Mm-hmm. My memory is a bit vague, but I think it was his success and obvious efficiency in those manoeuvres that made the final decision that he should take over SCIGS after Rawlinson's death. Mm.
Do you recall how that particular exercise you're referring to, with tank units attached, how it was organised, what its aim was?
The trouble is one's a little bit inclined to get mixed up between the First War and the Second. But I don't remember
the details.
Mm-hmm. Except he did score, as far as you can on manoeuvres, an outstanding success.
Yes.
In those manoeuvres.
Had he personally been commanding the tank units which were involved in the exercise?
No. Oh, they were on the other side, I think. But I can't tell you whether they were actually tank units engaged in that exercise. You see, after all, if you introduce tank units into the middle of Essex, the amount of destruction you could do was absolutely enormous. Most of the tank exercises were held in Salisbury Plain and places where they couldn't do any harm.
Yes, yes. When you joined Milne in 1927 as his military assistant, he had already been commander of the Imperial General Staff for a number of months. And initially it had JFC Fuller as his military assistant. Do you know whether that was a happy and effective working relationship?
Well, there was no personal acrimony. But Fuller was a man of ideas. And he was not a practical staff officer. Now, the job of a military assistant consisted in dealing with all the papers, and there were masses of them, were submitted to the CIGS and came from the Committee of Imperial Defence, from the other services, from the politicians, and so on. And to do the preliminary work on these things required practical ability, which, well, Bodyfoot frankly wasn't interested. I mean, you produce the draft army estimates for the next year, and all he would say is abolish a lot and buy some tanks and aeroplanes. He didn't want to get down to that sort of thing, and he was no good at it.
Were these impressions which you got from General Milne himself or from other?
The general atmosphere, yes.
I see. Reactions from other staff officers at the War Office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everybody admired Fuller. And he had a great many admirers, and he did a great deal to forward the idea of the use of tanks. But he was no good in that particular job.
Mm-hmm. I wonder whether you were able to judge through the conversations you had with other officers serving at the same time as Fuller was MA to General Milne. I wonder if you were able to judge whether Fuller's passion for mechanization enabled him to further its cause, or whether his ardour actually put people's backs up a little bit?
Well, I think it certainly encouraged the people who had advanced ideas and wanted to change things. But there must have been a few diehards who regarded Fuller as a nuisance because he threatened the abolition of all the army stood for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very natural at the end of a major war to want to get back to the old regimental system and go back to the old standards.
So Fuller, as it were, was looking forward, whereas many of his contemporaries were tending to look back a little.
Well, you've got to, when you reduce an army of a million men to a couple of hundred thousand, you've got to look back to get something that's manageable financially and otherwise.
To look at the precedents,
yes,
on which the pre-war army had worked, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. Did General Milne give you the impression that he had personally encouraged Fuller in his interest in mechanization?
Well, that's why he appointed him, because he wanted the benefit of his ideas.
I think there were other interesting people at the War Office who had a special enthusiasm for mechanization. One who I'm particularly thinking of is Charles Broad. Was he able to make a useful contribution to the cause of mechanization?
Well, there were a lot of very important people in that field, nearly all of whom Mill made use of in one appointment or another. Hugh Ellis, who'd been commanding the tanks, was a brilliant man. He commanded the tanks towards the end of the war. And Charles Broad, Tim Pyle, Martel, who invented a number of tanks and actually commanded a tank formation in the Second World War. Ron Carter, DSD, had very advanced ideas, and that's why he was made DSD.
Yes.
And you go to the top ranks, apart from Mill himself, his MGO, Master General of the Ordnance, Gilman, was also a gunner and a great help to him in trying to arrive at practical means of developing modern ideas.
Now, of the people you've mentioned, two who are of special interest to me are Charles Broad and Tim Pyle. Thinking first of Charles Broad, what sort of fellow was he, and what kind of interest did he have, and how did he help advance mechanization? You worked with him quite a bit, so you must have got some impressions of the kind of fellow he was.
Well, he certainly was a very enlightened soldier and had very advanced ideas. But after this lapse of time, it's very difficult to remember details. If one of the people one talked to on the subject of mechanization and future development, what the organization should be, which were all very difficult problems. Should you have a few tanks which you gave to the infantry in order to overcome opposition, or should you form tank formations of all arms? Did you need infantry with them, and how far you needed guns, and so on? All this was in a state of flux after the war. We'd had great successes. We'd broken the German lines with our tank force, but we still had a long way to go before we arrived at a permanent organization.
These questions of how to use tanks, which you've just drawn my attention to, while you were at the War Office, how much attention was actually given to them? Was there a formal structure for studying the problems and producing reports and things like that?
No, nothing new was set up apart from the general staff, which was the main thing there was to study. As you know, most important development was the production of what we used to call the Purple Primer, which set out an organization of all arms as being suitable for tanks. And that was copied by the Germans, who used it as the basis for their tank force that broke through French lines in the Second World War.
I think what I'm really driving at is I'm interested in how substantial an issue the question of mechanization was during this period at the War Office, and how much time and energy was actually given to its consideration as compared with the many other problems you had to consider.
Well, the other problems had to be dealt with. And you see, you got to go to the situation at the time. This country was practically bankrupt. The people demanded, I think rightly, a welfare state and a health service and all the rest of it. The population was still on rationing for 2 years at least after the war. The public and the politician had a great belief in the ability of the League of Nations to settle all international disputes. There's this tremendous peace campaign led by Lord Hugh Cecil, one of the Cecils. And, of course, the Versailles Treaty, as drafted, was considered a guarantee against German aggression. Then there was introduced the 10-year rule. And how, in face of all that, you could expect to get several million pounds for experiment and development and use of new weapons of war, for which you could foresee no practical use whatsoever, is quite obvious. And actually, of course, there were a tremendous lot of problems demanding conventional forces. For instance, we had the Army of Occupation in Germany. We had the problem of the control of Iraq, which took up a good many troops. There were all sorts of internal and external problems. And in India, we always had to be ready to send additional British troops out to India. Then we had the Shanghai emergency, where something like getting on for two divisions, I should think, were probably sent out there. We had the general strike and the Irish problem. Well, no tanks could, they might have been useful there, but it was all those problems were essentially ones for conventional forces. And then we had, of course, the crisis over Ethiopia, which exposed our nakedness in fact, every respect. I mean, we had ammunition reserves even to last a few days of war. And a considerable amount of money was spent in trying to put those deficiencies right. But there was no case whatever for abolishing conventional forces and substituting tanks, because there'd have been no use for those particular emergencies. And it's obvious in 10 years' time they've all been out of date.
Yes, those are very good points, well argued. We've talked about some of the leading personalities within the War Office. There was one person who was a major influence from outside of the service who I'm terribly interested in. And that's Little Hart, of course, who was very active as a journalist working for mechanization. Could you tell me a bit about what sort of relationship Little Hart had with General Milne?
Well, I knew Little Hart very well indeed. At the end of the war, he was invalided out of the services. But Milne had seen his articles and realized that here was one of the few military correspondents who was really interested in what was happening and could happen in the future. And he said he wanted him helped in every way possible. And he gave authority, whether formally or informally, I don't remember, but encouraged the staff to talk to him pretty openly about what they were doing. And he saw him himself on several occasions to show that they, at that period they were pretty close, was he actually proposed him to be a member of the Army and Navy Club. And I think he had a good many enemies at that stage, and the fact he was proposed by the CIGS made quite sure that he wouldn't be turned down.
What do you think General Milne was trying to achieve through Little Heart?
He wanted to educate the public and the Army in modern military equipment and tactics. Particularly the public, I think.
And he gave Little Heart quite a number of privileged access to information for this reason.
Yes.
I think there was a point where some of those privileges were withdrawn, and the relationship between Little Heart and the War Office underwent some change. Could you tell me a little bit about the reasons for that?
Well, of course, Little Heart and Boney Fuller got very frustrated because nothing was happening, or nothing material seemed to be happening. And they both turned against Milne and regarded it as his fault. Little Heart did a most incredible thing. In about 1936, he wrote two turnover articles, the centre page of the Times, arguing very strongly we should abandon all idea of sending an expeditionary force to France and give what assistance we could to France with air force. Well, of course, that had been accepted. It would have meant that the army in this country would have been reduced to a police force. Nothing more. And what is more, the French would never have resisted the Germans if we had refused any military support. What would that would have led to, God only knows. They might have even joined the Germans. There were a lot of pro-Germans in France and a great many anti-Russians.
What sort of impact did this article make on the War Office?
Well, I wasn't in the War Office then. I'd left the War Office as GSO 1 First Division. So I don't know. I know it made us... We were out in Palestine then. I didn't mention Palestine amongst one of the jobs that fell on the shoulders of conventional forces. We had two divisions out in Palestine trying to maintain order. But it caused my General Armitage, who was also a very advanced soldier, great indignation, and we concocted an article between us which we sent to the Times, which I think they refused to publish. Trying to reply to these.
During the 3 years you were with Milne at the War Office, was there in that period any change in the relationship between Little Heart and Milne, or throughout that period was Little Heart a privileged person?
Oh, I think he was, yes. Of course, a defence correspondent who is anxious to get news and to get publicity, he's bound to tread on a few toes. But in general, in that period, Little Heart was the voice who, with the general staff, could publicise their ideas. You see, it was quite improper for somebody in the general staff of the War Office to write articles for the newspapers, and they never would have done so. But he got all his ideas from the staff of the War Office. I always think that Little Heart never invented anything in those days at all. All his information, all his ideas were second hand. He got some from Boney Fuller and others, but mostly from people at the War Office.
You've partly answered a question I was going to ask you, because it's always interested me to what extent Little Hart was an original thinker on the subject of mechanization in the army, and to what extent he was merely collecting information from various sources and just presenting the information he had acquired.
Well, I would say that the latter one is the true picture, but of course he became rather an expert. But he gathered information from other sources too, besides the War Office, very much so. And he became rather an expert, but his ideas were practically all, at that period, at any rate, second hand.
Yes. I think over a period of time it's apparent from the things he wrote that he came to represent, as it were, the War Office view less and his own views more, and the views of perhaps certain people within the tank corps itself.
I agree. Mm.
What was he like to deal with him? How did you find him as a man to deal with? Was he an agreeable kind of person?
He was a great personal friend of mine. He used to come round to my house quite a lot, and I went to his and knew his wife very well and so on. Oh, yes, we were very friendly terms. He lived close to me.
So he's a personable fellow, was he?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I knew him very well. And admired him because he did a very good job.
Would you say admiration was the characteristic reaction to him within the service?
Well, there were people who regard him as a nuisance. I mean, if you start a campaign to say the cavalry ought to be abolished, you obviously will make a lot of enemies. And he was wrong on that. Absolutely wrong. Because in the cavalry we had a magnificent body of officers and men with ideas far in advance of most of the rest of the army, because they were a mobile force. And Milne hit absolutely the right thing to do with them, and that was to turn them into tanks. And of course, some of the best units of the tanks in the Second World War were converted cavalry regiments. And they had even an Indian cavalry regiment converted into tanks as one of the most efficient units in the Middle East.